Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a Dhamma talk from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. If you find benefit from this talk, please support the restoration, the preservation, and the presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma with your donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
Tonight's the beginning class of our 27-class structured study called Local Knowledge, Uncommon Dhamma, and it points to some of the lesser-known suttas that are included in this study. But we're beginning where the Buddha's Dhamma is practice, and explaining the meaning of becoming is really explaining how we practice Dhamma, how we engage in Dhamma practice. Everything the Buddha taught was to unite the mind in its body and to see things in reality as reality relates to Four Noble Truths, which means we, because of that well-concentrated mind, we're able to hold in these principles of the Eightfold Path and understand at a profound level what it means to be a human being. And what it means to be a human being, the way a human life is most meaningful, is when we're actually present for it. Makes sense, doesn't it? But that's the problem with a life rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. You're never present for the truth of human life because you don't know where to see it. Again, right view relates directly to that. I think everybody understands that. So the notion of becoming is a central theme of the Buddha's Dhamma, a significant central theme of the Buddha's Dhamma, and I never heard one mention of it in 30 years of so-called Buddhist practice. It was only when I came to the Buddha's Dhamma and came across these three suttas and specifically that I understood the importance of a well-concentrated mind united in its body, being able to observe reality as it unfolded. That's the Buddha's Dhamma. So becoming refers to what am I becoming in this instant? To be mindful of that. And if my thoughts, words, and deeds are well concentrated and framed by the Eightfold Path, then in this moment, I am becoming further awakened. If my mind continues to be rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, then the only thing that I can hope for to give birth to become in this moment, is to become further ignorant. It makes sense, doesn't it? If my point of view is rooted in ignorance, my experience of whatever it is rooted in ignorance. If I think a dog is a bicycle and I jump on the back of that dog, it's not going to get me anywhere, will it? Well, my dog might. We have to understand who we are in relation to what we're dealing with, what we're living with, if we're going to live successfully with that. And so in the Buddha's Dhamma, that focus is known as the three marks of existence. We went through that 36-week class last week. But you'll notice that different themes of the Dhamma all point to this one thing. What am I becoming in this moment? And that is the choice that we have, and it points to the potential that each moment has for a wise Dhamma practitioner. In this moment, I have the potential to further my mind towards awakening, or in this moment, and it's because now I know the difference, I can no longer ignore ignorance, I can continue to ignore ignorance. But now I have to do it knowing that I'm doing it, because I've developed the Dhamma. All right, so these three suttas, I'm going to attempt to get through them without a lot of commentary because I'd like to get all three. None of them are long suttas, but I hardly ever get to the Mula Sutta because of a lot of commentary in the first two. So I'm going to give it my best shot. But if you have any questions, if I'm reading too quickly or there's something that you need clarity on, just open your mic and holler at me.
Hey, John.
Yes.
Brett, is there a way to, for some reason, I can't hear you very well.
My mic is on. I can't think of anything else to do, Brett. Okay. You sure your volume is all the way up?
Yeah, it's all the way up.
I don't think I have another control for my microphone volume. In fact, I'm sure I don't.
Maybe I'll try to leave and come back in or something.
Yeah, does everybody else hear me all right?
Yeah.
Yes, no?
I hear you fine, John.
Okay. Brett, why don't you just log off and log back on? I'll give you a minute.
Okay.
So, those of you that have been on retreat will know that I always try to fit this, at least the first two suttas in, even if they're not scheduled as part of that retreat. And so I thought it'd be a skillful way to begin this particular structured study to kind of get all of our mind focused on this one point. What am I becoming in this instant? And as we develop the Buddha's Dhamma, then we can become wise Dhamma practitioners in this instant. If we don't, we can't. And it is just that way. The point that I'm making is, and some of you and other people do say this, well, isn't that unfair? Why isn't this available for everyone? It just isn't. A Dhamma that would be salvific, and that's Brett. Is Brett in? There he is. Hey, Brett, do you hear me? Hello, Brett! Brett, you hear me all right?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Much better, thank you.
Great. A Dharma that would be religious in nature, meaning teach salvation, would contradict the Four Noble Truths directly, wouldn't it? Because that's looking for some kind of resolution or escape from the common stress and suffering that is inherent in having a human life. It simply contradicts the truth of humanity. So the Buddha wasn't a savior. He didn't see himself as a savior. He didn't try to teach a salvific religion. What he taught, and he taught it in the most effective way ever, was how to be a human being and to be mindful of what we are giving birth to in this moment. The Loka Sutta. The newly awakened Siddhartha, now a Buddha, was enjoying the peace of release. So this is within about 2 or 3 weeks of his awakening. Established in concentration, he observed the world around him. He noticed human beings aflame with the fires born of the defilements of greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. Realizing the significance of what he was seeing, he thought, now just that line is important, realizing the significance of what he was seeing, remember the Nagara Sutta, where the Buddha describes first how he developed a concentration practice out of jhana meditation, and then how he applied that well-concentrated mind to be able to observe what he was becoming in his mind in that moment. You remember he realized he was caught up in that feedback loop of self-referential view, stuck in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, that way of thinking, and how through that well-concentrated mind, he was able to observe this process of what he was becoming. And because he was able to observe it and understand the context for what was occurring, he was able to change it. This is the Buddha's teaching to us. The Buddha's words. The world is a flame. Rooted in ignorance, my words, of Four Noble Truths, the world is afflicted by sensory contact and perceives suffering itself. So many of you will relate that directly to dependent origination that we're going to get to next week. And I'll talk more about that next week. But it's that coming in contact with our sixth sense base from a mind rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths simply continues to reaffirm a fabricated wrong view of self in relation to the world. The Buddha continues, rooted in ignorance, this mind misunderstands self and becomes anything other than self. Becomes anything other than self. That's a description of a human being's life. We spend our whole life becoming anything other than what we do, what we are, and all of us can identify with that. Did you ever have the feeling, just once probably, that you needed to be more, or something was wrong with you, or there was something lacking? That's what the Buddha, and that's the idea of fabricating what I need to be in this moment, because there's something wrong with me. I perceive a danger or a lack or something that is just not satisfying to me, and so I begin a process of grasping after something. And once I grasp after something that changes my way of thinking, notice I didn't necessarily say it satisfies because there's nothing that can, but it changes my way of thinking enough that I can use that to establish itself. And that is what satisfies my mind. Meaning, what I'm explaining here is we satisfy our minds not by gaining understanding. Is Becky here with us tonight? No. Becky sent me this incredible article from Discover Magazine where a physicist is actually describing this process, and it stunned me because they're so clear. I'm going to put it in the newsletter. But because we misunderstand who we are, we can only create something that we're not. That makes sense, doesn't it? If we're given the instructions for putting together a model airplane, but the instructions are for baking bread, we can't make the model airplane. It could be the most perfect instructions, but they're no good for baking bread. They're about making an airplane. If we don't have the right instructions on who we are in relation to the world? How could we possibly know? That's what the Buddha set out. That's why he left his life of luxury and power, to figure just that one thing out. Who am I in relation to the world, and why do I create so much stress in my life? It misunderstands self and becomes anything other than self. That's all that we can become if we don't know what a self is. Makes sense, doesn't it? And what is a self? What constitutes a self? Six properties. We're going to get into that in the near future. The Buddha's words. Becoming anything other than self, the world clings to becoming. Does everybody understand that? Once I've established this thing that's other than myself, in my case, when I was 15 years old, it was playing center field for the Yankees. I didn't care that I was 5'7" and slow-footed and a little bit dim-witted. I was going to play center field for the Yankees. In that moment, I became anything other than myself, didn't I? And I'm not talking, I'm not talking about don't have dreams about yourself and don't set goals, but the fabrication that I created in my mind that what I needed to be a successful human being in this lifetime was to play center field for the Yankees. And so I became that. That became my reason for living. And so if I don't become that, each and every moment is stressful because of what I'm holding out in front of me. Most people don't do it with something as silly as becoming center field for the Yankees, but we all do it with something. We all create fabricated identities that we now cling to because we have become that. And we became that not because of a mistake of birth or the fact that not enough gods are following us around and protecting us. We became what we became because of ignorance of who we are. That makes perfect sense, doesn't it? And it perfectly explains the Dhamma. We become other than what we are because we don't know what we are. What else could we do? Now we know. Becoming anything other than self, the world clings to becoming, is afflicted by that becoming, and yet we delight in that becoming, and don't we? Anytime we can establish a fabricated view and feel safe in that fabricated view, we feel safe, we feel comfortable, until something comes along to threaten the view, and then we lose our minds again. And that threat could come from anywhere because it's tenuous. It's, as the Buddha says, it's like foam on the ocean. Things constantly occur in the world to threaten our views of the world, not because of the world has any inherent brilliance to it. It's simply the nature of the world to show ignorance, to create stress and suffering out of ignorance. If the world wasn't, I'm not saying there's an inherent purpose in the world and the world is acting with some type of benevolent consciousness. It's simply the nature of the world as described by the Buddha. Dukkha occurs. As a consequence of having a human life, there will be stress and suffering. If I can choose, if I can follow a path that develops that understanding, then I can stop reacting to that stress and suffering that's inherent in having human life. I'm going to continue. I'm going to read that line again just because I might have talked this past it. Is afflicted by becoming and yet delights in that very becoming. In this moment, whatever I'm becoming, I'm delighted in it because I'm doing it. The next line is, where there is delight, there is fear. And if all of us would just think about that for a moment, you would realize that many of the things that you wanted to become had an underlying level of fear, even if it was very subtle, because you fear like you can't do it or you're going to lose it. Some of us, it has to do with manifesting as rather severe paranoia, meaning that every human being knows that they've created this self out of nothing and that there's nothing really supporting it. Some of us can't ignore that in ourselves, and so we have this fear. If any of you had a fear of public speaking, it's kind of like that you're afraid that if you get up in front of a group of people, they're going to see that this is all fabricated, that you made a lie, that there's nothing underneath what I'm putting out there to the world. And that's that constant stress that people are realizing, that medical science is realizing, is killing people because we don't realize it. We're the ones that add this stress to our lives because of fake views of self. And we become that fake view, but we have become a person that cannot be sustained, yet because of the decisions we've made internally, we have to sustain it. We're compelled to sustain it until we find something that shows us, wait a minute, that's just rooted in ignorance. Let it go. And that's how the Buddha's Dhamma works. That's what all these suttas are referring to, that, to understand this process that we're becoming. Where there is delight, there is fear. Where there is fear, there is stress. It's another clue to the Dhamma, isn't it? If we can address the root cause of fear and all the other characteristics of self-referential behavior, then we've eliminated stress. Where does the fear come from? The life integrated with the Eightfold Path is lived for the abandoning of becoming. That's the end of the sentence, but in the Dhamma we understand that the modifier that could and should be added there. The life integrated with the Eightfold Path is lived for the abandoning of becoming further ignorant. Those that say, the Buddha words, those that say escape from becoming is by non-becoming are never released from becoming. And the emphasis the Buddha puts on this, I declare. What is he talking about? I'm going to read it again. Those that say that escape from becoming is by non-becoming are never released from becoming, I declare. I'm going to ask somebody this question. Ram, what do I mean by non-becoming? And I don't mean to put you on a spot. It's very subtle. It doesn't mean all that much if you can't answer it.
No, that's one of the that's one of those little things in the sutta that I was struggling with. I saw your explanation. It went one side in my brain and popped out the other side.
That's right. I asked you because of the discussion we had over the weekend too.
Right. And that is still one of the things that I haven't quite squared into my head yet.
John.
Yes, Michael.
Can I take a shot at this?
Sure.
The way I understand it, non-becoming is the belief in a salvific practice that that rewards us in the end.
Yep. Your answer is correct. You get a gold star, but just missing one of the points because it's just not broad enough. Let me refer it back to them. Exactly the words Buddha used. The Buddha's words, the meaning of becoming is to not become further ignorant or to recognize that I am becoming further ignorant. Never released from that becoming is using some kind of practice, a Dharma practice, a religious practice, a philosophical practice, to establish some type of speculative establishment of myself in some non-physical realm. Nearly every religion does exactly that in one way or another. The Buddha recognized the cruelty and the constant distraction of creating something that we do. It's simply more eye-making. So when the Buddha talks about becoming and becoming something other than self, is just that, establishing in our minds an idea or an ideology or a result resting in some fabricated ideology of who I am. So the idea of a common Buddhist teaching would be, if I say this chant constantly and if it's on my lips when I die, I'll be immediately taken to Amitabha Buddha heaven to be taken care of. That's a belief in non-becoming, because you're establishing yourself in some speculative realm that is completely contrary to what the Buddha taught. The Buddha didn't teach any type of self-referential establishment in non-physical realms. He simply didn't do it. So that's the meaning of becoming and non-becoming. Is that clear?
Yes.
Okay. It's a common theme, the idea of non-becoming. Is becoming anything other than an awakened human being is non-becoming. The Buddha's word, stress or dukkha arises in dependence on becoming a self. With the ending of clinging to self, meaning clinging to ignorant views of self, and maintaining self, no stress will arise. Key to the Dhamma. Look at the world. Human beings afflicted with ignorance crave for and cling to becoming. And that's true, isn't it? We constantly want to keep adding to this anatta, these wrong views of self. All forms of becoming, anywhere, in any way, are impermanent. All forms of becoming, anywhere, in any way, are impermanent. Stressful and always subject to change. Again, in other words, the Buddha is referring to these non-physical realms. Even the idea, if I'm a baker, a bread baker, I don't know if you heard that, I wouldn't say banker, could be banker. If I'm a baker, but I decide in my mind that in order for me to be happy and successful, I have to be established as the world's greatest baker, no matter what, that's the becoming that I've created in my life. In other words, no matter what happens in my life, I have to become that and maintain it because that's my view of self. So even though I might end up being a very successful baker, in my mind, I'm always grasping after becoming the world's greatest baker. Does everybody understand that? So the most subtle aspects of becoming is really the fabrications that we play on ourselves, the magic trick that we play on ourselves, that we think that the person we think we are and that we're holding out to the world is actually us. We've just become something other than what we are, even if it's what we're actually doing. Is that clear to everyone? And so where's the resolution in that very subtle understanding? It has to do with right view. In this moment, am I continuing with I making root in ignorance? Or in this moment, am I at peace with being the world's greatest baker? That's the difference. A person who's constantly grasping may be the world's greatest baker, but they won't consider whether they are or not. They'll simply go out and bake some good bread tomorrow. The Buddha continues, knowing this, knowing the arising, the passing away, from right view, craving for becoming and non-becoming is abandoned. When I read these lines, it's hard for me to understand now why I kept buying into a Dharma practice that was rooted in just the opposite of this, becoming anything other than self. But the reason was, is I was never taught this. And when I finally realized it, this is one of the suttas that helped me understand the entire Buddha's Dhamma and this understanding what I am becoming. And in this moment, just to say it again, the only thing that I can ever become is a human being. But it's also the greatest gift to actually become a human being, isn't it? To know what we're doing here. Craving for becoming and non-becoming is abandoned. From the abandonment of craving for becoming and non-becoming comes unbinding. We talked a lot about the fact that was an underlying theme on our retreat. Unbinding, but unbinding from fabricated views of self in relation to the world. From the abandonment of craving for becoming and non-becoming comes unbinding. Excuse me. For those unbound, from lack of clinging and maintaining, there is no further becoming. The Buddha is just talking about once we get to that point of human awakening and continue with our Dhamma practice, there will be no further becoming ignorant. It's not possible. Once we have eliminated ignorance from ourselves, from the way that we think, it will not, look like someone's trying again, it will not come back again. The Buddha says that repeatedly too. He continues, they have conquered ignorance. They have completed the task and have gone beyond becoming, in parentheses, a self rooted in ignorance. That's the end of that sutta. Yeah, that's the end of the Loka Sutta. Does anybody have any questions about that before? I want to get right to the Bhava Sutta. But I don't want this to feel like I'm trying to rush through this. I just do want to get through these three suttas. And yeah, we'll be done by midnight or so. The Bhava Sutta. Even during the Buddha's time, there was confusion regarding the meaning of becoming. These are a commentary or not. Here Ananda, the Buddha's cousin and chief attendant, asked for clarity. Okay, here's the sutta. On one occasion, Ananda went to the Buddha, bowed and sat to one side. He was unsure of the meaning of becoming, and so asked the Buddha, becoming, becoming, to what extent is there becoming? The Buddha replies, Ananda, if there were no karma ripening within the feeling property, would the feeling property be noticed? Does everyone know what that means? Karma ripening in the feeling property? Does anyone know what it means? This is why this is such a key sutta. Karma is one of the most misunderstood teachings of the Buddha. I don't think I ever heard it applied correctly until I actually read the Buddha's words. Karma is the present moment unfolding of past intentional acts moderated, meaning our experience of that is moderated by the present level of mindfulness. So karma is not a grand series of behavior modification through reward and punishment. It has nothing to do with that. Karma is the present moment unfolding of past intentional actions moderated by the present level of mindfulness. What does that mean? It means that our experience of what is occurring is moderated by how we're holding what we're holding in mind. It relates directly to becoming. If in this moment I'm holding in mind the principles of the Eightfold Path, then I'm inclining my mind toward becoming awakening. And so I'm taking the momentum of karma, that is unfolding in this moment, present moment unfolding, of past intentional actions, but I'm moderating my response that is generated by that conditioning via karma. I'm moderating it because I'm now thinking differently. My mind is a little bit more well concentrated, and I'm starting to see things from right view. And so I'm able to take that repetitive reaction that I have to life, the Groundhog Day effect, that some of you might relate to that, Groundhog Day effect. And even though the feeling that's arising in this moment feels like that same feeling I had yesterday when that person was in my face, I now can take a breath, unite my mind back in my body, and realize the I-making in this moment, and simply move on. That's diminishing the effects of karma. If in this moment I continue to react in the same way that I always have, the only thing I'm doing is reinforcing that particular ignorance and the manifestation of that that's called giving birth or rebirth to a karmic influence. Does that make sense to everyone? Does it really? Because it's important to understand this. Okay. So that's karma. If there were no karma ripening within the feeling property, would the feeling property be noticed? So what the Buddha is referring to is to a mind rooted in ignorance, it has a feeling. And if that feeling is a pleasurable feeling, that mind and body, that person will grasp after more of that. That's establishing karma for the next time that chocolate cake arises in life. The conditioning that I instilled in myself, now known as karma, compels me to crave for that chocolate cake and maybe more than just one piece. That's a practical teaching on karma. If in this moment I can come to grips with my own compassions and addictions and compulsions, I can take a breath, be at peace with one piece of chocolate cake, and there's nothing left to provoke that grasping after and clinging to the next piece of chocolate cake. As far as karma is concerned around chocolate cake, I brought that to cessation through direct action and understanding. Is that clear to everyone? So using these teachings to deal with chocolate cake is important if chocolate cake has the best of us. But that's the very gross application of the Dhamma. At its most subtle aspects, we're talking about our relationship to our thoughts. It'll become more clear if I get through this. Would the feeling property be noticed? Ananda's words, in this way, no, it would not be noticed because there's nothing provoking the reaction. So then a feeling is just a feeling. It's just an appropriate feeling for what's occurring. The Buddha's not teaching, and I'm not teaching, that as we awaken, we lose the ability to feel. In fact, we gain, and I can tell you from firsthand knowledge, those of you that have seen me lose it on retreat would know that this is true. As you develop a real relationship with who you are as a human being, your feelings become much more poignant and you can trust them. And I didn't even understand, if somebody said that to me a while ago, I never would have even understood it. But I can tell you that one of the greatest freedoms I've gotten out of the Eightfold Path is the ability to trust what I'm feeling and what I'm thinking. I no longer have a confused John over my shoulder saying, you don't know, you don't know, you're an idiot, you don't know, you're wrong, you need something else. It's gone. It's gone. No, wise teacher, the Buddha continues, in this way, karma is the field, consciousness the seed, and craving the moisture. If there's one teaching you should remember out of this, is this one. In this way, karma is the field. Think of that. Think of the metaphor the Buddha's using here. Karma is a field we're going to grow our awakening, or we're not. No, don't strike that. Karma is a field we're going to grow the rest of our lives on, beginning in this moment. Karma is that field. Consciousness is a seed. What I'm holding in mind is going to determine what's going to grow in the field of my life, in my karmic field. And so if my consciousness is rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, the only thing I can give birth to is another moment rooted in ignorance. If in this moment, what I'm holding in mind is the principles of the Eightfold Path, then I will give birth to that moment. Go back to it again. In this way, karma is the field, consciousness is the seed, and craving is the moisture. So it's craving, constant craving after self-establishment that continues watering the seeds of my own ignorance that are manifesting as my life called karma. Is that clear to everyone? That is the Dhamma. That is the Dhamma. Don't ask me to repeat it because I probably can't. The consciousness of human beings, rooted in ignorance and bound by craving, is established in wrong view. The consciousness of human beings, rooted in ignorance and bound by craving, is established in wrong view. So what's the solution? What disestablishes, if that's a word, ignorance? Right view, seeing things clearly. All the Buddha is saying is, guess what, folks? As a consequence of having a human life, you just don't see yourself and the world clearly. And here's the way to do it, through understanding Four Noble Truths. Establishing wrong view, renewed becoming is produced. Establishing wrong view. If there was no karma ripening, then in the form property, meaning in this body right here, right now, would the form property be noticed? No, wise teacher. Meaning that what Ananda is saying here, he understands that in this moment, with no karma ripening, the form, feeling, etc. of the five clinging aggregates are not noticed. What that means is in this moment, there's no self-referential views. I'm not noticing this fabricated self. That's what Ananda is responding to. The Buddha continues, in this way, karma is the field, consciousness the seed, and craving the moisture. The consciousness of human beings, rooted in ignorance and bound by craving, is established in wrong view. Established in wrong view, renewed becoming is produced. And yes, the Buddha is reiterating that point. I'm not just getting confused. If there is no karma ripening in the form or the formless property, would the formless property be noticed? No, wise teacher. And I'm going to skip over that, what the Buddha just said, in this way. Yes, and that's the end of the sutta. So again, the Buddha's just reinforcing to be mindful of what we're producing in our minds in the moment. So it's even beyond the fourth aspect of the Eightfold Path, right action. It's much more subtle than that. It's getting to the point where we understand, what are my thoughts producing within me in this moment? And if my thoughts are producing anything that is stressful or distracting, I know that that thought is not rooted in wisdom of the Four Noble Truths. And so in that moment, I'm watering the field of ignorance, using the metaphor. If in this moment I can see things from the framework of right view, even if it's burgeoning right, developing right view, in that moment my mind is inclined away from karmic results and inclined towards awakening. Okay? All right. We're going to the next one. It's got to get to it. Give me a moment. I think these three suttas will really set the tone. Oh, someone left. Sorry, I lost my place. Where is it? Gotta be here. Huh. Give me a second, folks. Sorry to keep you waiting. Sorry. Oh, well. I can't find my reference. I'm going to skip it.
We're waiting for your next becoming, John.
Here it comes. All right. I'm going to read the Mula Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha asked the monks assembled a rhetorical question. Monks, if those of other sects ask you in what are all phenomena rooted, how do they come into play, what is their origination, how are they established, and what is their foundation, what is their governing principle, what is their defining state, what is their heart food, where do they gain footing, and what is their cessation? On being asked this, you should reply. It's asked a lot, isn't it? This sutta points to the importance of authentic Dhamma in this present moment. All phenomena are rooted in the answer. All phenomena are rooted in desire. So the Buddha is not saying as a consequence of creating physical phenomena, we have to have desire. Again, remember the context of the Dhamma. the phenomena that's causing distress and distraction in my life are rooted in desire. It's because I've attached something to them. I've attached a wrong view of self to whatever the object is. All phenomena comes into play through attention. That's another word for what I'm holding in mind. So the Buddha is inferring a type of wrong mindfulness. And the seventh factor of the Eightfold Path teaches that clearly. We can hold in mind, mindfulness means to hold in mind. We can hold in mind things that continue to water the field of karma, can't we? Or we can hold in mind the principles of the Eightfold Path and so produce awakening within our minds. All phenomena have contact as their origination. Again, the Buddha is pointing out to a mind rooted in ignorance that the phenomena that I'm getting attached to is rooted in contact. My initial contact with something then leads to the reaction or the response, the mindful response, determining what I will experience in this moment. Is that clear? It's simply another way of describing karma in some different words. Buddha continues, all phenomena have feeling as their establishment. And how many times do we use feeling to describe the quality of our life? It's probably the most common question we ask each other as human beings. How are you feeling? And often when people ask, how are we doing? We'll describe it in terms of how we're feeling in that moment. Or maybe clinging to yesterday. I'm okay, but boy, yesterday was a tough day. That's describing yourself by feeling. And again, I'm not talking about we don't communicate with people how we're thinking and how we're feeling. But we don't create identities by how we feel and how we think. We don't do this to ourselves. We don't insist that in this moment, in order for me to be happy, safe, and secure, I must be feeling different, something different than I am. Why? Because I can't. I'm feeling what I'm feeling because I'm feeling it. If I want to stop reacting to feelings and thoughts, I develop the Dhamma so I have a well-concentrated mind so I can bring that process to cessation. That's what the Buddha's teaching here. Or if all phenomena have concentration for their foundation. All phenomena have mindfulness as their governing principle, meaning all phenomena, our experience with all phenomena, and we are phenomena too, internal and external phenomena, has mindfulness as their governing principle. There's another sutta on this that we get to in our study. What does it mean, the governing principle? It means that my experience, my view of something, my understanding of something is rooted in what I'm holding in mind in relation to that something. So if in related to who I am in relation to the world, the governing principle for me to understand who I am in relation to the world is the Four Noble Truths. That's the governing principle. All phenomena have discernment as their defining state, meaning how I discern something, the perceptions of what's occurring will define my experience with it. All phenomena gain footing in impermanence. All phenomena gain footing in impermanence, meaning all phenomena, no matter how permanent it seems, we touched on something that I say often on retreat, that continuity obscures impermanence. All things are impermanence. But we establish that the phenomena by giving permanence to that all things that are impermanent. It gains footing in that ignorance of impermanence, related directly back to the three marks of existence, right? Everybody understands that? All phenomena gain footing in impermanence because we try to establish something as permanent where it can't be established, which is everything. All phenomena have unbinding as their cessation. All phenomena have unbinding as their cessation. All phenomena, meaning release from all phenomena, has unbinding as their cessation, meaning release or unbinding from all views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths is the unbinding that releases us from all the karmic influences that we've created in our life. So that's the meaning of becoming. I hope I explained it well. Peace. And if I didn't, please ask me, because this is, this leads into the whole rest of this structured study. So let me know what you think. I'm going to start down here with Tim. How are you, Tim? Excuse me.
So you had said something earlier when Mike brought up that point on non-becoming and non-becoming, but I kind of took it where it was close to the karmic concept, and it had to do with rebirth and birth, not so much of having anything to do with believing in anything but salvific or false dharma. So that's number one. But then it comes back, this teaching comes back to something we talked about when we were going over the precepts, and that is, you know, and I wrote this down, and I said it before, and I think this, and I want to know if you think this is close to what becoming is meant to be, that all suffering, delusion, aversion, and despair, dukkha, is a result of anatta, craving that which is impermanent, be permanent, anicca. So isn't that the process of becoming and then non-becoming over and over again?
Well, yeah, anything that would be that would continue to establish fabricated views is what's being referred to. And then in a broader sense, becoming refers to the immediacy of Dhamma practice. What am I becoming in this moment? And that's kind of the important thing to remember about that, because this is, the, as we know, this is the only place that Dhamma practice can be practiced is right here and right now, in the midst of what I'm becoming.
Wrapped around impermanence.
What do you mean?
Yes. Well, it seems like the impermanence, the coming to understand the impermanence of things stops. That's why I guess I see the similarity between karma, birth, rebirth, and becoming and non-becoming.
And yep, they're all related. I'm sorry, Tim. I didn't hear the last thing you said.
I'm having a hard time seeing the difference between birth, rebirth on the karmic end and becoming and non-becoming.
Oh, well, they're the same things, but they're the different verbiage is useful to describing the actions that I'm referring to, but they're basically interchangeable.
Okay.
Birth, yeah, again, well, we talked about this on retreat a little bit. We have to use words to communicate. That's how most human beings communicate with words, unless you can understand sign language. And we do a lot of verbal, non-physical communication, but we're just talking about teaching. So one word can have many, many different meanings. And in order to understand the meaning of any word, whether you're learning the Dhamma or American history, the context is important. I'm going to use an example just because it makes a point, but I'm not going to use the word. You can use one of the most awful words that we use today, and I'm talking about within races, and it's just a horrible, to me it's one of the most disgusting words. You all know what I mean. It begins with an N. But in the right context, it's appropriate to use the word, isn't it? When you're describing something that relates to that. Or even describing this awful word that people use to describe a race of people. That's appropriate. That's not wrong speech. But to use it in a mean and attacking type of way is. So a word can mean many different things, and sometimes it can be hurtful, sometimes it's not. As far as birth and becoming, the verbiage used here is, it's easier to say, what am I becoming in this moment, than to say, what am I birthing in this moment in terms of teaching it? But you could use the same exact words. So karma is it's a concept used to describe something that's related to the Dhamma. It's also a concept that's used to describe something that is very popular in pop culture. So it's when I say karma, I have to explain this is what I mean, because most people think it means something else. The same thing with birth and rebirth. Most people have birth and rebirth caught up in a physical act, and it is. But that physical act of physical birth and death have almost nothing to do with what the Buddha taught. So in this particular sutta and in this setting, it makes more sense to use the word becoming, because it takes me and the Buddha completely away from physical birth that gets people hung up on. Yeah. I think that might be the most important thing to bring out about the point you just brought out, Tim, is it's very difficult for a human mind to not think of birth and rebirth as something physical, but as Dhamma practitioners, we need to remind ourselves that's not the significance of those words. The significance is what's occurring right here and right now. Thank you, Tim. Did that help, though, Tim?
I don't think I articulated what I meant.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. No. We'll talk later. But I know, and I you did clarify it, but.
Okay. Well, let's have a conversation about it then.
No, I've taken up too much time, but I'm okay with it. But I'll shoot you an email.
Great.
I'll articulate it better there.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Kevin, how are you tonight? Kevin. I'll unmute your mic. Kevin, are you there? I'm gonna go on. I can't unmute his mic. He might have left the room for a moment. Brett, how you doing tonight? Hello, Brett.
Thank you. I definitely got a lot out of all the suttas. And could understand where where they were directed from, and karma, and how aversion in a confused mind gets established. And what were your causes on the fear? Can you go over that again?
What was my what?
When fear arises,
What about it?
What were the causes of that? Just wanting things to be different.
Well, yeah, any type of fear, and I'm not talking about irrational fear. Like I was asked this question when I was teaching the Anatta Lakana Sutta on our first retreat, and a person got very upset because they misunderstood my teaching and the Buddha's teachings on not self, and they thought it was teaching annihilation. Or actually went too far, and they thought that we're not talking in any way to have a self-reflected view as far as taking care of ourselves. So the question that was thrown at me is, well, what do you do if you're standing on a train tracks and a train is coming at you? He misunderstood me teaching that that the self is nothing. And of course, the answer is you take two steps to the right. The Buddha's Dhamma isn't teaching annihilation. He's teaching us directly how to be a human being. Is that answering your question?
I guess I'm probably looking for some kind of answer to say, what is the solution to for it, which
to fear. Well, the solution is in the Dhamma. In other words, fear arises because of self-referential views. Not the fear of a train coming at me, I better get off the train tracks. That's a rational fear. It directs me as a human being to take two steps to the right. But right. The fear, the constant underlying gnawing fear that something bad is going to happen to me, or the fear that I might not get what I want in the next moment or the next day or the next lifetime, those are the types of irrational self-referential fears that destroy our lives. And that's what is recognized and abandoned, those types of fears. And so the Buddha's words here, and they're so powerful, where there's fear, there is desire. It shows us, if we're fearful in any way at all, we know immediately it's because I want something to be different than it is, whatever it is. And even going back to the metaphor of the train coming at me, in that moment, the fear is rational, but it's still caused by something that's going to hurt me.
Right.
The rationality in that moment is to move. But if then in that moment I'm constantly afraid to leave the house because a train might hit me, I've lost my mind again, haven't I? Because I'm taking things too personally. So that's what it means. Where there's fear, there's desire. Whenever there's fear, there's eye making. Unless it's just for preservation of human life. Good question, Brett.
Thank you.
How are you, Karen?
Hey, everybody. Hi, John. Thank you so much for the talking about the suttas. I think I'm just going to listen and absorb tonight.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm glad you joined us. I'm going to try Kevin again. Kevin, you there?
Yes.
There you are.
Just to follow on what Karen said, really appreciate these talks and sequence and you structuring this study, the way you've curated these suttas, I'm really looking forward to.
Yeah, me too.
Seeing the jewels that you polished off, venerable sir.
Yeah. Excuse me. I am too. I think this is going to be a remarkable study. And this is going to be my next book too. Our teachers helped me do some proofreading recently, and it's about ready to be published. So I'm looking forward to that. So. Michael and Julia, how are you, Michael?
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Hey, John. I'm just going to oversimplify everything. How's that?
Great.
You don't mean that, do you? Give me one second.
The Dhamma is simple.
You know what? It actually, I wouldn't say it's simple, but it's definitely, something we can relate to, okay? We
hope
can
so.
feel it and live in it, and we can sense it when we're not. So, and it actually all comes down to wrong view or right view. So I just wrote something very short, and I'm not going to take too much time, and I think it kind of like, it's applicable to your readings. Becoming is confusing wrong view with right view. It's the magician's trick. It is one of the five clinging aggregates. By understanding the relationship between ourselves and the phenomenal world through the three marks of existence, we are able to discern right view and the cessation of becoming, occurs. That's it.
Beautiful. I lost you on the screen. There you are. Outstanding. Julia, how are you?
Very good, John. Thank you. I wrote something a little longer. Mine is a dissertation, but I'm going to try because I tried to answer the question of becoming, or not becoming, but of like how do we stop it? But first, I have like a little thing about becoming, and so this is what I wrote: consciousness rooted in ignorance conditions the mind. Each moment holds a potential for continued ignorance or unbinding. Becoming refers to immediately giving birth to another moment rooted in ignorance and giving rise to this diluted thinking and stress. When we are impeded by wrong view, there is a lack of understanding that all phenomena is impermanent, including the self. When we misunderstand this self rooted in ignorance tries to maintain its ego self by clinging to maintain the self and make permanent what cannot be permanent, further becoming this ego self. Fear arises with the potential of this loss, and further suffering is incurred. So, how do we stop ourselves from further becoming ignorant? How do we stop ourselves from binding ourselves to impermanence? We practice right mindfulness, right concentration in jhana, and with right intention, we hold unbinding. What is held in the mind becomes intention and will determine experience. That's exactly what you said. So this is mindfulness. In jhana, we deepen peace and equanimity, giving us the clarity that we to finally see in right view that life is ephemeral. We can become disenchanted finally. When we become disenchanted with our own decrepitancy, a body of veins, tendons, fluids, hair, nails, we can dispassionately understand life as life unfolds. We can, with compassion, view our old self or the wrong view we had in the past and realize that this is not me, this is not mine, and this is not who I am. And then because of this, unbinding within ourselves, with compassion, we can understand the plight of others and further unbind us as we walk the remainder of our days in peace and equanimity. So that's what I wrote, John.
That's beautiful.
That's my whole explanation.
It really is. It's wonderful, Julia.
I don't know if you agree, but...
I agree completely, especially that last line.
Thank
Nothing
you.
Like a life lived in peace and equanimity. No? Thank you, Julia. Ram, how are you?
I'm good, John. Picking up again. This whole becoming... in the Buddha's Dhamma is just so fundamental. Every fabrication that you have leads to becoming.
Yep.
It leads you you know, out of your present moment, it leads you to the past, the future. I heard Tim speak on impermanence, and even the fabrication of denying impermanence, when we establish that so-called permanent self, that's already an act of becoming.
Yes.
Because your attention leaves the present.
Do you see, Ram, that as long as I follow these Ten Commandments, when I die, I'm going to this wonderful place called heaven? That's the essence of non-becoming?
Yeah. Okay. The reason that my confusion came from, I'm starting to get a fairly decent grip on becoming. I was looking at unbecoming as the opposite, and it isn't.
Yeah, it isn't.
It's just a different way of becoming.
Yep. It's true annihilation of self, in any way. It's so subtle, because even a thought that I'm the world's greatest banker is that deluded, fabricated thought. It's taking me out of. It's creating a non-becoming experience for me.
I'm still looking for this one quote where the Buddha says, "Even the smallest bit of excrement has a foul smell," and in the same way, we are abhorred by the smallest bit of becoming.
It's not the Upajjhatana Sutta.
I can't find it. I've the only reference I find is pops up in a book by Stephen Batchelor, but I haven't been able to get to it.
I think look at the Upajjhatana Sutta on the website. I think that line is in there.
Which one?
Upajjhatana. If you can't find it, just send me an email. I'll give you the link.
Yeah.
I think it's in that. But, I think I remember.
Yeah, he puts it out that, like, this is, we're not kidding around here.
Yeah.
Every bit of becoming that you see in yourself, root it out.
He used similar lines like the wise know the danger in even the slightest discrepancy, meaning the slightest variation to the Dhamma. That's why you hear me say over and over again that a Dhamma that is even just a particle impure, meaning a fabricated thought, doesn't work. There's no close in Dhamma practice. It either is or it isn't. But that's why it works too. The confusion that the Buddha saw during his time is the same confusion we have over our time, that's rooted in wanting a practice to be a practice of non-becoming. The practice actually does that. The Buddha's, the radical difference is that he taught how to not become something that we can't be. I think it's remarkable. The more I learned about the Buddha and what he actually figured out, it's hard to understand how anybody could come to that without a Buddha to teach him. It's much easier for us because we have a guy that said, this is what I found out, and it makes sense, and we can experience it ourselves. But to figure this out, glad it wasn't up to me.
His intensity and his drive, when you look at, when he went into ascetic practices, he wasn't kidding about. He just about killed himself.
He thought his salvation was there, and that's why he did it. That was his wrong effort, but you could say it was a lot of right effort to get him to that. That's another discussion. But all right, thank you, Ram. Deborah, how are you? Welcome to our sangha again. What did you think of your class tonight? Wait a minute. I can't unmute. Oh, there. There you are. Hi, Deborah. Sorry about that.
I feel like I'm incredibly blessed to be sitting with a whole bunch of Buddhist scholars. And I think I need to start with reading your book. I don't know what Matt was thinking. I mean, I know what I know, and spending 2 years with him, seeing him twice a week, and every visit we have these discussions that are around a lot of this. But as you read through everything, and it moves very quickly, and, I might absorb 10, 15, 20%.
Yep.
of familiarity, but there's just so much I don't know that I'm not sure I'm in the right place yet. But I do get the overall picture as it drifts by, but not to really, I feel there's something, there's a missing step here for me.
Yeah. Oh, thank you, Deborah. There is, but it's really just a matter of becoming familiar with the material. Pardon me?
I'm sure that's what it is. And even through the discussions that each person has given on their own assessment of what they understood has also helped a lot unfold as well.
That's the importance of a well-focused sangha. It's not just the teacher. It's not just the scriptures, if you will. It really is a well-informed and well-focused sangha that makes this work. And so we're so fortunate to have what's developed here.
You are. It's amazing. It's an amazing community.
It is. Yeah. I mean, I'm the teacher, but that's all I am. You know, the teacher is only good enough as the people that practice it. And these are some amazing practitioners. I've been around the Buddhist game for 40 years, and honestly, I've never seen anything like this. And I know that sounds self-aggrandizing. It sounds like I'm saying I did it, but I know I didn't. I don't practice for all of you. You do your own practice, and it really is. We just had our retreat an online retreat this past weekend, and our four new teachers presented for the first time, and it was just remarkable. I was going to mention it later, but those talks are up on the website, the talks and the video, so listen to them. And getting back to you, Deborah, take your time. You'll hear me say, I hope you hear me say, because it means you're coming to our classes, to be very gentle with yourself and with the Dhamma. What you just said, everyone else has said the same thing in the beginning of their practice. It seems overwhelming. But if you just keep coming, keep applying it as best you can, you'll have many aha moments where it just makes sense. And
I have a lot of aha moments, but like I said, I think I just my knowledge of what I practice and what I use in my life is so based on Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, very practicality, very practical, needing things to be different, understanding where suffering comes from, all that. But this is so specifically, about things that I don't know about too. So, and then I just need to. Maybe you and I can have an email on the side or something, or talk, and you'll help me decide which way and how to go forward, so I can maybe supplement myself.
Absolutely. Why don't you send me an email tomorrow,
I will.
And then we can set up a time for a talk later on in the week. Perfect. And get you going in the right direction.
Okay. Thank you.
It looks like Jeff has left. Do you know if he's still?
See, Jeff has very, little. Has had very little in what I've had, like 10 times more, 20 times more. So this was, he sort of texted me that this was like being in a Princeton University physics class.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't mean to present that way, but sometimes the material comes across.
We Matt knows me really well, and he knows Jeff a little bit. And I'm just incredibly wowed that he thought that I could step right into this class. So there must be something there, but we'll figure it out.
Yeah, you will. And
but I love what everyone said so far, your group. I don't know everybody's names, and they're not on here, but so much of what this woman here, I don't know her name. I'll point to her. She's with her husband in the log cabin.
Oh, Michael and Julia.
Yeah, Julia. Julia, they said some really, things are kind of condensed and reduced and simplified.
Yeah.
I get it a little more.
Yeah, so again, there was a lot of material here. Don't let it feel overwhelming. It really isn't. Just be gentle with yourself. The same offer to Jeff. If he wants to talk about it, just send me an email. We'll set up a call.
Yes.
But everybody here, including me, started out, what is this? And it's made such a remarkable impact on all of our lives. So
absolutely.
Thank you for joining tonight.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Everybody.
Hello, Helen. Over in Trout House.
Hello, John. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And hello to everyone. I've really missed everyone. This is probably the hardest part of the coronavirus culture we're in right now is not being able to go to Sangha with all of my people.
Yeah.
I too really enjoyed what Julia wrote. The clarity of it was beautiful. Very well written, very well summarized. I also had the privilege of running into Lorna recently, and she had such wonderful things to say about the retreat. So I look forward to being able to listen to all of that. My work schedule has changed and now includes Saturdays, so it's hard to fit more things in. But I do look forward to hearing more about the retreat, listening to the tapes from the retreat. Yeah. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Helen. Russ, good to see you.
Hi, good to see you. Oh, I just enjoyed listening to the sangha or to the teachings tonight. I thought you did a great job of bringing clarity to it, and you know, I got a lot out of it. So thank you.
Thank you, Russ. Glad you joined us. Trevor, how are you? Good to see you tonight.
Good to see you, John. Good to see everyone else. And yeah, thank you for the teaching. I really love digging into these suttas together. That's really special. So yeah, thanks for arranging this tonight. Yeah, two quick things. One, I just wanted to say, I love this line. If there were no karma ripening and feeling property, would it be noticed?
Yeah.
Because I was kind of trying to understand that contact piece, link in the chain of dependent origination, and that the way you described that one was quite helpful.
Yeah.
That's something I'd like to sit with longer and maybe have some more conversation with you.
Yeah.
And the second point I just wanted to raise, I'm not sure if I can articulate this well or if anyone might resonate with this, but speaking of becoming, sometimes my sense when working with a system like the Buddha's Dhamma, which seems at times a bit esoteric to me, a little bit hidden, kind of going back to what we were saying at the retreat, like, you know, you have to have just a little dust in your eye. I certainly have too much dust in my eye at the moment. So the challenge I'm sensing is when it's a little esoteric in my experience of it, it does have this journey-like quality of almost like becoming, like I'm striving towards something that I don't have to understand, to come to right view. And so it just makes me, yeah, I'm just kind of wondering about that. Is it just very seductive to get into becoming in our own spiritual path? Not so much about like becoming, quote, awakened or something, but just in terms of coming to that right view that we currently lack, kind of feels like a state of process of becoming, which also gets me thinking in terms of, is any view just impermanent anyway?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm just kind of circling around all these different thoughts. The other line that came to my mind was something I read once, that enlightenment is recognizing there is no enlightenment. There is no need for some kind of dramatic insight. So I don't know. Just kind of swimming in those thoughts. I was wondering if anything like that was ever part of your journey, if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah, you bring up another really good point. Grasping after enlightenment is not the way to get there, but recognizing it is. And so the Buddha teaches this over and over again, and I hope I bring it out, that the actual recognition of developing understanding of Four Noble Truths is part of Dhamma practice. In other words, we notice it. And I would say it's pretty dramatic, even though it's authentic. But you use the word esoteric. Esoteric means hidden. And so there's nothing hidden in the Buddha's Dhamma at all. But I think because it's utter, to use a word, it's utter obviousness. You know, it's almost like we're too close to the reality of it to see it clearly, until we're ready to see it clearly. But there's nothing hidden in what the Buddha taught. It only seems so because we don't understand it yet, which is how the Buddha describes the process. It's not achieving something or acquiring some type of hidden knowledge or hidden establishment, non-becoming. It's simply episeko, coming and seeing what it really means to be a human being. And so in that way, there is nothing esoteric about the Buddha's teaching, is it? It's just, it's right here, it's right in front of us. But because we don't know it yet, it seems, even the idea that I'm going from a misunderstanding of self to a complete and profound understanding of self seems pretty esoteric and magical and mystical and all those things at first. But it is in the practical experience of that that I go from a so-called mystical view of myself in relation to the world to understanding, wait a minute, I'm a physical human being with an ongoing thought process. That's what I am. That's the Dhatuvibhanga Sutta, isn't it? There's nothing hidden about the six-propertied person. And let me just explain that briefly for Deborah. The Buddha teaches that a human being, all human beings, are made up of six properties, and they can be nothing else. The four elements of earth, wind, fire, and water, a fifth property called the space property. Those elements need a vehicle to manifest within, correct? And the sixth property that every human being has is consciousness, but it's consciousness that is malleable. It's consciousness that could be rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, or it's consciousness that could be rooted in wisdom. Those six properties are the sum and substance of every single human being, and a human being cannot be anything other than those. Can't be more, can't be less. We can do things in our life. We can acquire things. We can attach things to ourselves. But when we understand all that we can ever be is this six-property person, then we stop grasping after things such as even enlightening this six-property person. Because a six-property person can't even be enlightened, can they? They can just be a six-property person. But it's in the understanding that you are so-called enlightened. You understand reality. So there's some pretty interesting subtleties, but in the end, it's very obvious. Does that make sense, Trevor?
That's helpful. Thanks, John.
Yeah, it's right here. And if we still don't know it, like if we don't feel like we understand five clinging aggregates, for instance, it's not a matter of finding the hidden meaning behind it. It's simply a matter of continuing with Dhamma practice, and we'll understand those things that we don't get yet. Thank you, Trevor. Great question. Hello, Lorna.
Hello, John. Hello, everybody. Hello, Helen. Good to hear from you again. The becoming is, speaking for myself, I think I spend most of my time in becoming, in fabrication. I think the sutras that you read tonight are difficult for us to wrap our heads around, because it points us to the obvious that the unbecoming is there at every opportunity, and yet we can't seem to live there. We kind of want to be in the becoming and not in the unbecoming, not in the pure pureness of what the Buddha discovered. And I think it was probably that Trevor was maybe talking about, that it seems elusive, but it's because even the bit of understanding that we do have as a layperson, that even just understanding it and knowing it, we're streets ahead of a lot of other people.
That's true. Yeah.
Even though we can't sort of really live in that unbecoming pure state where we have no anatta and we're only the six properties, which is our achievement, you know, that's what we're sort of striving for. But anyway, that's just what I have to add anyway. But I've enjoyed listening to your talk and the comments, and they're very good. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you, Lauren. I'm glad you joined us tonight. Jane, how are you?
I'm still feeling the calm from retreat. So I just want to let Deborah know we're not all Buddhist scholars.
Yeah.
Some of us are newbies too. So, John, I like what you said, that your Dhamma practice has developed to the point where you can trust what you're feeling.
that it's, you know, it's appropriate for what's occurring. And that's somewhere, I'd like to have that trust at some point.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm pretty sure you're developing it like we all are. But what are we, the contrast to that when you say or when I say it, I can remember not being able to trust my feelings or my thoughts because I was doing things that I couldn't believe I was doing at times. Not terribly hurtful things, but just things I wish I wasn't doing. And yet here I was doing. But that's what I mean. That's what living a life like that is, literally living a life when you've lost your mind. And, people have different degrees of that. But if you're not living an authentic human life, you're living a life of non-becoming. You're not living a human life. That's what the Buddha realized. That's what we realized. Thank you. Josh, good to see you tonight. Let me unmute you. Hold on. Come on. Wait a minute. There you are. How are you, Josh?
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
I've lost the picture for some reason, but that's all right. Well, I'm kind of a newcomer, as you know, and things are banging around in my head now. But I really identified with the beginning of understanding how all my life I've been fabricating who I am and trying to live up to those fabrications and suffering as a result of that. Then from the seminar, I was getting the concept of how fabrications eventually do lead to becoming, which again bring us back to ignorance and not understanding the Four Noble Truths.
Mm-hmm.
Where I got lost a little bit was in the sutta where the Buddha says, it's by getting rid of becoming and non-becoming, because they're both impermanent, that we start unbinding. And so I think I got a little bit, I can't see the forest for the trees right now because of the terminology. I'm not sure if I understand the difference between becoming, unbecoming, and non-becoming. My mind says if becoming leads back to ignorance, then non-becoming would be desirable, but obviously I'm wrong on that. So that's where I'm at.
Thank you, Josh. It's really remarkable what you've, the understanding you've developed in just a few weeks. The confusion is because we want to look at opposites. In other words, if we're using becoming and unbecoming in the same sentence, we must be describing something that is related to one object, but the opposite aspects of that object. But it doesn't mean that. It really does mean the same thing, but in reference to the way a human being thinks of themselves. So becoming is becoming something in this world that is unfolding in the present moment. I'm the world's greatest baker is an example of that, but it's also the same thing as a speculative existence. In other words, I can think in my mind, I'm the world's greatest baker. It's my job to run my bakery. And I can get caught up in that aspect of it. But I can also have a mind that as the good baker, I'm going to keep doing all the things I need to be to maintain my position as the world's greatest baker. But because I want to make sure I get some reward when I'm dead, I'm going to go to church on Sunday. That's a belief in unbecoming and non-becoming, because I'm establishing myself in a non-physical realm. And that could mean anything. In modern Buddhism, non-becoming could be chasing after Buddha nature or Buddhahood, because that's a speculative ideology. It's not based in reality. So it's really two sides of the same coin rather than something that is opposite of each other. It's all rooted in fabrication. There's another sutta I can't think of right now where the Buddha talks about becoming self and becoming anything other than self. That's that the emphasis there is the this constant compulsion, the constant self-referential focus on self and maintaining a self. And if I can't do a good job here, at least I can do a good job in another life. And do you see what I'm... So they're both a distraction. They're both the same thing.
Okay,
well, it's a different application of that.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great question. Thank you for asking it. Is everybody else clear on that, what Josh brought up? Mm-hmm. Because, again, it points to the immediacy of the Dhamma. Each moment holds the potential to either continue my own ignorance of Four Noble Truths or to continue in Dhamma practice and incline my mind towards awakening. And when we develop Dhamma practice, as we all are, maybe Deborah's not quite there yet, but it sounds like you're moving there, that creates this this very subtle but powerful purpose for our lives. There's something about deciding that in this lifetime I'm going to use these teachings to awaken that brings, for many of us at least, a real poignancy to each moment, because this is the moment that I have chosen to awaken. And if it's not quite now, I know that with this practice, it will. It's right around the corner, as long as I keep practicing. The corner might be a long corner. It might take us 2 or 3 weeks to get to the corner. It might take us 2 or 3 years to get to the corner. But as the Buddha teaches, once we are on the established the path of becoming awakened and stay on that path, we will. So that's enough for tonight. The talks are up there. Go listen to them. Our teachers did a great job. I am not going to be like the Truth or Happiness course. We're going to just do one class at each class. In other words, Saturday's class is going to be different than this class. Next Tuesday's class will be different than Saturday's class. And so the next three classes will be Dependent Origination on Saturday, the Four Noble Truths next Tuesday. Then next Saturday will be an analysis of the Eightfold Path. And then we'll get into the more lesser known suttas. But I think this is going to be a great study. I hope it is. We'll gain some understanding out of it anyway. So any other questions or comments before we finish? All right, we'll finish with metta as we always do. These are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support the continued restoration, preservation, and presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma. If you find benefit here, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.